You're storing memories to lose them again. You'll forget everything when this whole thing ends. You can't even predict what tomorrow brings. But don't lose track of living in the present.
Welcome to the Memory Distillery, everyone. I'm Anthony Veneri.
And I'm John Deck, and each week we will malt, mash, ferment, and distill our way through the spirits of our past in the form of long-loved movies.
And on this week's episode, love me, say that you love me. That's right, we're watching Romeo and Juliet from 1996, directed by Baz Luhrmann, a listener request, right, John?
Oh yeah, this one came from one of our listeners, Nicole, and it's a bit of a birthday surprise.
That's right. Happy birthday, Nicole.
She has great taste in movies and brought up quite a few movies that, you know, she is hoping that we do at some point. And just kind of said, hey, maybe do one for my birthday, which is May 18th. So shout out to Nicole. This movie and its review is just for you. But I do have to take you to task immediately with this, Anthony.
Okay.
We're doing Romeo and Juliet.
Yep.
Quite often nowadays, when we get into the opening segment of our show, you've pulled a little soundbite. We have a little bit of the movie that we play, and instead you're singing the Cardigans to us. And I don't have a problem with the song, but you know, with my rich Shakespearean background, you didn't even come to me and say, "Would you perform for us, John?" Instead, you just went right for the pop culture classic.
John,
yeah.
If you want the stage, by all means, please step up, take the stage.
I don't
Sing
know.
Sing your heart out for us, John.
I don't know if I could. Okay, if I profane with my unworthiest hand this holy shrine, the gentle fine is this: my lips, two blushing pilgrims, ready stand to smooth that rough touch with a tender kiss.
Bravo! Bravo, John!
I mean, I'm just saying that once upon a time, I was, I don't know if I would say forced, but I did have to learn a few different scenes from Romeo and Juliet. And I can say that being someone who, like, was an English major in college and, like, had all these ties, like, I was not someone who was really into Shakespeare, and I just didn't get it, but it's like, oh, blah, 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 he's the greatest and all that. But it was really through seeing his plays performed that I got into the language and the wordplay and understanding the how well his words tell stories just beautifully, rhythmically, and in, I don't know if we're going to call him Baz or Boz, but Mr. Director Luhrmann.
My apologies in advance for butchering names.
But, you know, he brings a certain cinematic flair that's undeniable. Whether you like it, love it, or hate it, it's a unique vision, and it always brings something very very pleasing to the eye in terms of flair and just grandioseness. And so his interpretation of this particular, probably, I mean, got to be the most, you know, well-known Shakespearean play outside of maybe Hamlet. There's a close tie there. But, like, seeing this come to life with an adaptation of it being in more modern times, but with the same language and delivery, I really love this. And I haven't seen it for quite a while, but that's really just almost like an oversight. I think sometimes, like a lot of things with Shakespeare, you forget how something good something is until you're confronted with again. So I'm really looking forward to watching this again, because it hasn't been quite so long in that I'm going to say maybe 15 years or so ago, but still, that's a huge amount of time. And I really want to see if I have the same recognition of this interpretation of this classic hit as being as on fire as I remember it, or is it going to kind of feel dated and overdone to me? Like, I don't know the answer to that. I think it'll be very interesting.
See, I haven't watched this pretty much since it came out, and I was going through a phase in the mid to late 90s, as I'm sure a number of guys did my age where all the girls were really into Leonardo DiCaprio.
Mm.
And so it probably in a fit of jealousy, most of us were like, oh no, Leonardo DiCaprio movies, that's crap. No, I'm not going to watch that. And so I'd watch it once and then I'd be able to say, oh yeah, no, that movie sucked. And I don't remember this movie sucking. I remember this movie being good. And I probably just said that it sucked to, you know, get under the skin of people who liked Leonardo DiCaprio. But I'm older now and less edgy. And so I have a feeling I'm going to go into this and appreciate it a fair bit more than I did as a teenager. So I'm pretty excited to jump in and watch it, actually. So what I'm thinking is we go and do that. What do you say, John?
No, I can't. In good faith, I can't do that yet until I also unveil that, like, I wasn't even edgy or cool enough to hate on Leo just for the sake of the fact that you said. It made perfect sense what you said. I followed you, and I completely understand the motivation. But I wasn't even cool enough to have people to alienate by pretending I didn't like him. So even going, you go back to Growing Pains and stuff, and just like when I first was introduced to his character there, I think I've always had a bit of a admiration of his style, even as it's matured over time. You know, I mean, come on, once you get eaten by a bear, where else are you going to go? But
the Oscars.
But like, so he was fine. I had no problem with him. But really, I think at the time it was the addition of Claire Danes as Juliet that I found to be so appealing at that younger age, after, you know, being such a fan of My So-Called Life and really, you know, all that. Like, this just felt like what a great pair of star-crossed lovers. Like, this is just going to be really great. And I mean, a brilliant supporting cast that I think I'm going to rediscover, you know.
Oh yeah. John Leguizamo, yeah. Hal Perrineau, like,
yeah. So it's like, it'd be interesting to watch Harold playing a role where he's Mercutio instead of calling out for Walt. a little lost joke for those who know. Anyway, yeah, now that I've voiced my unreserved appreciation for those involved, we can go and rewatch this.
That's what we're going to do. It's not streaming anywhere for free, so if you want to watch it, you can get it on your favorite streaming rental service, or if you have it in your personal library, or if you don't, if you know where to get it otherwise, go ahead and do that. And when we come back, we are talking Romeo and Juliet. John, are you ready?
Sin from thy lips? Oh, trespass sweetly urged.
Let us hither thine. Nice. Forthwith.
No, you crushed it.
Did I? All right. Do you bite your thumb at us, sir?
Is that your intro back into our podcast?
It is.
That's very Shakespearean of you.
Welcome back, everybody. We just got done watching Shakespeare, and I gotta tell you, John, like, I mean, I know this story. We all know this story. Like, we read this in school, and it was, you know, very much kind of a, it's sort of one of those mainstays of English class, right? Like, you're going to read Romeo and Juliet at some point in your school career.
Sure.
So we all know this story, and I even knew going into this sort of what to expect in terms of visuals and things like that, but I didn't really remember sort of the nuances in the filmmaking and things like that. And there's a fair bit to go over here, but I wanted to sort of lead on that foot of like the filmmaking aspect of this, especially because it was very strange in some regards. Like, there's this weird sort of time thing that happens. Mm-hmm. Like, you have seemingly normal real-time moments that seem sped up, and then I rewind and realize, oh, this is sped up to, like, 1.2 times speed or something like that for effect. And I was like, oh, that's a clever little bit of filmmaking. And, like, at first it was jarring, And then I sort of came to not necessarily expect it, but to respect it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I feel that there are things about how this movie were made that garnered it all sorts of praise, as well as people tearing it apart when it came out. And that kind of fell into both camps. There were people who felt that Baz's take on this was
Baz Luhrmann's
was overdone, unnecessary, too flamboyant, etc., etc. They felt it was more of a distraction, that it didn't really serve the purpose or the material. Like, that was one camp. And then the other side was the stylization was a way to bring energy to the characters that, you know, people just hadn't experienced before in traditional showings of it. So yeah, it's definitely something that's been remarked on. But yeah, watching it again now and not only knowing technically what they were doing to achieve said effects, but just the fact that these were the choices that were being made on so many different levels. I mean, exactly what you said, and then even more on top of that, I found that, I'll say that some filmmakers, Baz included, there's a certain flair and flavor that can miss the mark for me. But in this case, and in several of his other films, I feel that stylized approach, I really grow to appreciate. And so it's still not my favorite of his films, but going into this, I had a very middle of the ground take. I had no negative feelings, no super positive feelings. It was just kind of, all right, let's just re-examine this. And I mean, I really do enjoy Shakespeare's works in general, and like the wordplay and what goes on there. So what am I going to feel? And I came away with a very positive reaction for a number of reasons. And just like you're with what you're leading off with, the visual style and flair, I think, helped lend itself to the storytelling. It wasn't there just for dramatic impact. It was there to kind of help set the table for a delicious dinner of words.
Yeah, I agree. Although the words were, I was going to save this for a little bit later, but I figure why not just jump in now with that too. There were some parts of the delivery of this dialogue, and I'll preface this with, it's completely understandable given that it's 500 and at the time 500 years old or something like that. The play. There's some parts of the delivery of some of these lines that were just sort of difficult to swallow, and I get that a lot of it has to do with evolution of language and like the way that we use words and the way that certain colloquialisms just sort of die off after a period of time. Like we don't say certain things anymore because they just don't work or whatever. And I had that with this, and I give it a pass again because it's, you know, a 500-year-old play or whatever, but it was still there, and it was still something that sort of took me out of the moment. And in an otherwise brilliant bit of filmmaking, in my opinion, it there was something to that that I was reminded, oh, these are actors acting in a movie and not, you know, actual star-crossed lovers.
Yeah, I feel to some extent that's going to be unavoidable to a certain level, almost by design, and being the format being more of a you know, a play environment where you can't not think that, but yet you could still be absorbed into this. I do think there were moments that were so well performed that even like I just lost myself in the moments here and there. But I think at some level I was always conscious that this, you know, the level of performance of what was being executed didn't have the same element of escapism in totality that other movies do have that don't have the bit of a language barrier. But that being said, I find that having seen not only a ton of different Shakespearean plays and movies based on the plays, but also a lot of movies based on the premise of many Shakespearean plays, but with modern language or totally different takes on things. I think the core language is something that it was, again, a kind of a daring take and almost an artistic flair, just as much as wearing, you know, all the Catholic Mary symbolism, you know, things, and all of the different color statements and punk versus hip hop statements and like all these different things going on. I think choosing to keep the language of the play 99.8%, you know, in line with what the actual words of the play, did I say play or movie? Anyway, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think that choice, in and of itself showed a certain level of interesting dedication given the flair and the updating of time, and you know, like some things kind of hit you over the head. Like, I don't need a close up on every gun every time demonstrating to me that it either says rapier or dagger, or, you know, like that's cool and all, but it's like, I got it after the first time you did like a close up shot of the name of the gun. It's like, okay, I get it. So when they quote and say, you know, like, put your sword down, like, I get it, it's a sword because the name of the gun's a sword, or, you know, things like that. But, you know, okay, I'm not gonna like overly criticize the movie for little statements like, or little, you know, bits and pieces like that. But yeah, in terms of the overall delivery and the language and stuff, I do think there are times where it felt a little more artificial, and there are other times when it felt far more organic and just really in the moment.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. And going back to what you said about the guns and how, you know, the name of each blade is printed on the gun. Like, I get that a little bit, but there were times, more than just the first time, I think, where it really had an effect. Like, the most poignant, I think, is probably when Mercutio, like, throws his quote-unquote dagger into the ground to go after Tybalt. Like, that, I thought, was a very cool thing. Like, because who throws their gun down in the sand to land barrel first and have it be, like,
that's what I always knife? Do.
Like,
that's my go-to move.
I mean, I do that with my guns, too. If I'm about to throw down, you know, 16th century style, I throw my gun down.
I'm always like,
to stick it.
Guns in the sand, I'm the man. That's always the. Yep, that's what I say out loud, and everyone's like, "Whoa!" And they run away because they know I'm about to get crazy. Speaking of things that are crazy, you took charge and dove right in the direction of how we open this. My choice for opening was going to be to talk about music.
The music was lovely, right?
I really, really liked it a lot. Like, there were one or two things that were fine, but I didn't care. Like, but they kind of fit that flair of that, you know, 90s update and things that bled in there. But I particularly loved what they did with Radiohead in this.
The closing score, the closing song being exit music for a movie, it was fantastic. Well,
the thing I found out is that Boz approached Tom and Radiohead to write this song after giving them the last 20 minutes of the movie and saying, would you write a song for the end of my movie?
Yeah.
I had no clue. It's like, I think it's an OK Computer. I can't remember which one, but like, I love the song and the album, but like, I never knew it was literally exit music for a film. Like, I just thought that, okay, cool. Like, you're eccentric Brits, you're just going to call it that. That's cool. But like, I went back and just reading through the lyrics of the song and really, you know, just feeling it out. And just that whole aspect of, you know, we hope your rules and wisdom choke you, you know, now we're at one in everlasting peace. And like that refrain that we hope that you choke, like that, you know, like several times, like, it's like, oh, okay. Like, it just clicked for me. I was like, now this is just the song, you know, the movie came out 25 years ago or whatever. And so it's just like, to now, just now, be like, oh, wow, okay, I connect that. But I think within the movie itself, like, I love the use of Talk Show Host, the song by Radiohead, mm-hmm. as like Romeo's theme, like his kind of emo theme. Well, everything's emo with Romeo. like, I really love the use of that. And I love the use of The little moments, there were so many different like songs where they didn't even do the whole song, but just like a line from a song where there was something in the lyrics that described what was going on within the movie. And I know that sounds like a very basic thing, but the fact that this was a Shakespearean play transferred to film, you didn't have a lot of room to throw in your own words or your own insights or your own whatever. So having that echoed in some of the words of the songs was like a really clever way to add in some more color and some more context things in that modernization that wasn't changing the words of the movie.
Well, and the musical direction, I think, throughout it, you're right, is it's very good. Like, there's, when you want to get the sort of effect that you get from music in sort of building up tension or really giving you a feel for the scene, besides just sort of what you're seeing in the dialogue that you're hearing, the musical direction, getting that down, you usually have to have sort of a bespoke score written for your film. So you bring in someone like a composer to write a score and, you know, play it over your film. And the musical direction that they went in with this, in doing sort of a mixture of like pop music of the era, and then also, you know, adding in or rearranging songs to be, you know, sung by a choir, as in the case with this movie. Yeah. It was really, really masterfully done, and I really, really, really liked it a lot. Like, it worked so, so well for this.
Yeah, Prince's songs I've heard at least in 2 to 3 movies where they have them resung by choirs, whether it's kids or you know, full-on adult choirs. And I think there's a certain epicness to them that lends itself to that performance. And so it's like, when that happens here, it's just like, what a brilliant effect. And the, you know, opening lines of, you know, when doves cry, you know, like the way, the impact of that. I mean, and I think there's a familiarity with the song that, you know, attaches itself to what you're witnessing. So it's kind of like polarizing and kind of breaks things apart, but it also stitches it together at the same time. So yeah, I appreciate that. It's a very different feeling than, say, other musical soundtracks that we are in awe of, like pretty much everything done by Quentin Tarantino and what goes into the soundtracks in his films. It's a different kind of awesome. Here I felt like it was just like, you know, we've expounded a million times on how great these Tarantino soundtracks are, but I feel like with this, it was just especially well chosen for the film moments and the moments in story, as opposed to just being great songs with a great vibe that really, you know, work well. These are more like incredibly good storytelling moments. So I really like that.
Well, and I think it's arguably something that you can come to expect from a Baz Luhrmann film. Like,
yeah,
granted, Baz only has like 3 features under his belt. Where
five,
excuse me.
And Elvis coming out soon.
Okay, so there's that. But you have Quentin Tarantino, who has done, what, 8, 9 features now? Like, of his sort of, I'm only going to do 10 kind of thing. So it's something that you sort of come to expect from a Quentin Tarantino. And it's something that's maybe not something that's at the forefront of your mind when you think of a Baz Luhrmann film, although maybe you should when you consider this and like Moulin Rouge, for example, being sort of in that resume. But it's something that's just, it's so cool.
Yeah, I think the only film of his I have not seen is Australia.
I haven't seen that either.
So I can't speak to that, but yeah, when I think, I mean, I really, really like his version of Great Gatsby a lot, and I even going back to Strictly Ballroom, it's a weird movie, but it's fun, and I like it. So yeah, so everything you said about, like, you know, with it being a relatively short resume in terms of the number of films, and yet there's a consistency, certainly in style. And it'd be interesting to really kind of listen or rewatch a few of these. I mean, Moulin Rouge is an exception because it's more, you know, a flat out musical. But like, But, you know, having a soundtrack woven into the film like that, I always appreciate it. So I'm glad, you know, just take a moment to say, good job, Lerman.
I do have to make an admission here, and I do ask that you not judge me, but ultimately you're going to. I've not seen Gatsby. Mm.
You know, whatever. It's got Leonardo DiCaprio in it, so you're probably still you've seen one Leo movie, you've seen them
all, so...
All your rage from when you were young, it's spilt over. But yeah, stylistically, like I love like what they do in that movie, like inspires me to wanna like, you know, buy a house and decorate it in certain neo noir styles that are portrayed in that movie. It's just like, it's just so gorgeous to look at, and it's well done. But yeah, so basically, you know, when it comes down to it with this movie, I think, you know, we probably had slightly different reactions or, you know, being in or out of the moment. But I think there were some moments that even surprised me that I was so involved. I had no intention or precognition of being emotionally impacted by the film. But damn it, if it wasn't, you know, for like when they're in the midst of, you know, Juliet being quote unquote dead and Romeo, you know, being in there and as he's about to take the poison, the way they film that, the you know, talk about just putting a big tragic boot to your throat. It's
the,
just
the
like
sudden shock of it and yeah.
Yeah, and like their emotional reactions and everything Leo did prior to him, you know, taking the sip of poison and then Claire's reaction to him, like I was actually starting to tear up and was just like, man, I was so in it. And I just didn't expect it at all because, like you said, we're all familiar with the storyline. Even if you had never seen this movie or never heard of the play, you get twice. You get the prologue. You get in the beginning that tells you exactly what's going to happen in the movie. So nothing's going to shock you because they're talking about, you know, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life. You know, this is the story, you know, like this, and unless it was a Disney version, you know, we're not going to just change it and, you know, make it cool and everyone's happy at the end. But it's one thing for something to just be tragic in and of itself, like on a level where it's like, oh, that's a damn shame, that's tragic. But it's another thing when it's like heart aching in your face, visceral.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's a huge credit, I think, to the casting that they did in this movie. And I'm not just talking about Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes, but if you look all the way down the list, like John Leguizamo and Harold Perrineau and Brian Dennehy, Paul Rudd, who apparently traveled back in time to film this from a week and a half ago because he looks exactly the same. The man does not age. Miriam Margolis and even Emmett Walsh as the guy who creates the poison. Like everyone was so perfectly cast in this, yeah. And so you get, you know, going back to what I was saying about the sort of stilted nature of some of the line delivery in this, they still position themselves in such a way that you almost don't care. Like it's just they do their best with what they have, and most of them really just shine. And at the top of that list, obviously, is Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes, who just crush it. Like, it's no wonder that this movie did as well as it did in the time, and why it's still regarded as a pretty great adaptation of this is because, like, they just crush it. And you still, to this day, you can watch it and go, wow, I'm choking up at this really emotional scene. Or smiling when the famous balcony scene is occurring. Like, yeah. You can't help it because it just draws that out of you. And those are some of the lines, I think, that are able to be delivered well, that do translate well into modern English versus, you know, the I don't know if it's Middle English that was sort of going on in the days of Shakespeare or maybe, you know, early modern English, but
it was It was in England, so they just called it English.
Well, yeah, but I mean, thinking back in a sort of anthropological sort of way, like the ability to take what was there and understand what it meant and how it was supposed to be delivered, and then taking that and turning it into something modern is not an easy thing to do, and they do it exceptionally well.
Yeah, and I think, in my opinion, with pretty much everything like Shakespeare related, when you see it performed, it's the essence of the performance that gives you the understanding of what's happening. In the same way, you can listen to a song, you could be moved by it, but like 10 seconds later, you can't repeat back the words you just heard because it kind of went in and out and you get the gist of it, but you can't quite remember the exact phrases and words. I think it's the same thing with this, where there could be moments that come and go and you understand the scene, you understand the emotions, you understand the impact and what's happening. But like if you pause the movie and said, what was that last line? You'd go, something was unclean. I don't know. You'd be like, the point was they were unhappy, or, you know, they were feuding and they're about to kill each other, but you can't, you know, like, so it's almost like a flowery filler to take you from moment to moment, as opposed, at least from our perspective now, in our detachment from it, where it's very moving, but like the content is also, there's a reason why. You know, 7 or 8 or 9 times in this movie, you hear a phrase and you go, oh, yeah, I know that from Westworld, or oh, yeah, I know that from this, or oh, yeah, like being one of, if not the most quoted writer of all time, is just like there's so much that goes into a turn of phrase that are present here. And so even the things that aren't necessarily always like super well-known quoted things is just fun to have. Fun in the delivery of an authentic Shakespearean line that has transcended time and sounds fun and in play in the moment.
You know, I just thought of a good way to sort of relate it is, imagine you took Spanish for a year in high school and you remember just enough to sort of get by, and then you watch a show or a movie in Spanish and go, oh, I remember that word. I remember that word. Oh, I know that word. I know what that means. And you can sort of piece it together, even without the subtitles, you can sort of piece together what's happening with emotion and body language and things like that. And we get a lot of that here, I think.
Yeah, you could hypothetically take high school Spanish and then hypothetically watch Telemundo and, like, you know, look at these different soap operas and really get into it. And you couldn't get judged for that, right? Because it's just like Shakespeare. Is that what you're saying?
No. That's not what I'm saying.
I'm pretty sure that's what you're saying.
I'm trying to relate the aspect, the language aspect of it, but you go ahead and try to make this about me diminishing Shakespeare into Telemundo.
Oh, I mean, yeah, exactly. I wasn't talking about me. It was, yeah, Shakespeare slam. No. All right, so...
Get that drop.
So Juliet is... 13.
Yeah, like 13, 14.
Yeah, no, 13. Like, they quote, like, in the line, they say she's not yet 14.
Oh, that, okay, yeah, you are correct.
So, it just always strikes me, again, like, I know that we're dealing, first of all, it's 500 years ago. You know, arranged marriages and kids being wedded off, you know, essentially as soon as they're, like, you know,
capable of producing children.
Yeah. So it's not like scandalous, you know, in regards to that. And yeah, it'd be pretty creepy to have, like, you know, someone who looks like they're, you know, barely, you know, a teenager being in these intense, you know, love and marriage scenes. And it'd be just, if not creepy, at least weird and hard to process. But like, there's still that thing that happens. I have no clue what the actual difference in age between Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes, and I really don't know the difference between Romeo and Juliet, because I don't think they actually ever say Romeo's age.
I think it's implied that Romeo is roughly, he's within a year or two of Juliet, I believe.
So how are they driving? No, I'm just kidding. I'm not like obsessed with the whole age thing as much as I think it's interesting that, I know that for Baz that he, I believe I should say, I don't know for a fact, I'm pretty sure he always wanted Leonardo DiCaprio as Romeo, but I think originally he wanted Natalie Portman as Juliet. And to the fact where they, like, she was flown to Australia and she ran lines with Leo and they were going through stuff, and they determined that visually at the time the age difference looked way too pronounced, and that for whatever reason the pairing of those two together just made Leonardo DiCaprio look old, like a grown-up, and she looked like a little kid. And I thought what was interesting is that in this performance, I think they matched up perfectly well, where, yeah, if you said he was maybe a year or two older, okay, like, I wouldn't think, oh, he's an adult and she's just a little kid. Like, so I think they did a good job with the casting, and not just from the acting performances, but matching up and trying to get that, like, young, impetuous teens, moody, being drastic, doing crazy things, but then also, like, not that, like, typical, it's a high school TV show where everyone's obviously 32 and, you know, that kind of thing. So it's an interesting balance to try to attain, but I think they did pretty good on it.
So I think that was a good choice as well. Like, because if you think about it, Natalie Portman was in Star Wars Episode One in 1999 and looked like a child, and probably rightly so. She played a lot younger, I think, than a Claire Danes, who was hot off this came pretty much on the tail of My So-Called Life. She had a very busy 1995, and then into 1996 got to Romeo and Juliet, and so she, I think, could play a little bit older and have that difference in age, because Claire Danes and Leonardo DiCaprio are 5 years apart. So having that difference in age, a little less stark looking, is super important, especially when you're trying not to be a creep and have this look like a creepy sort of film. So, and I that's one thing that I think that they did exceptionally well. Two is they put a lot less focus on the ages of Romeo and Juliet and made it more about the story and the tragedy that befalls them.
Yeah, and it just makes me think about the nature of the film, how it's depicted, the acting, the ages, all these kinds of things. But, like, so Shakespeare, again, fairly obvious for anyone who's taken the most basic of classes, that you have his comedies and then you have his tragedies. And there's just something about that I think we meaning our current culture, not you and I, of course.
Of course.
No, but there's something that's lost in the idea of being able to embrace one or other of these in totality. Now, I think there's probably almost as many quotes about the differences between tragedy and comedy as there are quotes from Shakespeare, but like at its core, like it's just that idea of like I think Shakespeare, this could be a horrible misquote, but I think he said like a tragedy is a comedy that's misunderstood.
It's something along those lines. Yeah.
But whatever it is, whether or not that's actually him or just something close, or if it's another writer from the time who wrote that as a quote and got passed off as Shakespeare lit. Oh, wait, that's a totally different discussion. The point is just thinking about this movie as a tragedy and how antithetical it is to what Hollywood typically would want to share as a movie. That tragedies are very rare, and there are sad movies. But a tragedy specifically where it's avoidable, you know, there's a there's just either a fatal flaw in a character that drives them to make a mistake, or there's a miscommunication, or there's that, if this would have happened a half a second different, there could have been a happy ending, but there wasn't. And yeah, it's all tied to family and to pride and anger and like all these other things. But in its core, there's like a moment that everything hinges on where it could have been okay, but it wasn't. And that's the tragedy. And I think that it makes for interesting, if heart-wrenching, storytelling, but it also, it begs the audience to just contemplate what it means to lose something. It makes you really, if you are open to it, it makes you just contemplate the nature of life and what you can miss at any time based upon what can happen in a split second. And it's not necessarily done in that, you know, dramatic play-like way, but I imagine for a lot of people, you know, who've experienced tragedy or things where they may recount and think about a moment and think if that changed or what was different, what would that be like? So it's like that the catharsis of seeing things play out and recognizing it as a real thing, even if it's in a trumped up stylized Shakespearean drama, but at its core, there's this moment, a tragic downfall that occurs. Like it's something that I think is missing in so much of what is created in the storytelling vibe nowadays.
Yeah. Going back to the quote from Shakespeare is, a tragedy is a comedy misunderstood. And I think that that's at the core of what you're trying to say. So there's so much about life that and this is something that Shakespeare really writes about, and you get a sense of in the various plays that he's done. There's so much in life that has this kind of duality to it, and you can view it through one of two lenses, essentially, is either something that is comedic or something that is tragic. And like one example might be my I don't know, my car didn't start, and in one sense it's like, oh, you know, this is tragic, it's going to ruin my whole day. And on the other hand, it's like, oh, this is funny, this is a story I get to tell later and laugh about with my friends.
Well, if it's Shakespearean, what would happen is that you would laugh about it with your friends and then get married.
Yes, correct, because everything ends in marriage in a Shakespeare play.
If it's comedy, yes.
If it's a funeral, it's a tragedy. Tell me about your favorite character in this play / movie.
Well, in this movie, I'd say, I really did appreciate certain moments from both Leo and Claire, like, tremendously. I like moments with just about everyone, but I think it was Paul Rudd as Paris. Just
really
the like having such a small amount and just having that kind of affable, like watching how much he did with how little he had really just made me very happy, especially the dancing scene. I think everyone's eyes are probably on Claire Danes and on Leo, looking, giving each other, you know, the lovey-dovey eyes across the room.
Sure.
But I was watching his reaction to how he was dancing and looking at her and like nodding, like every time she made a face towards Leo,
I did good, right?
Yeah, yeah, he's like, oh, good. Yeah. You like this, huh? Oh, okay, cool. Like, but it wasn't like in a creepy way. It was like in a wonderfully
clueless way. Do you way appreciate
that,
me?
Yeah. So it was like, I just had so much fun with that. But I'd say that there's characters also, especially when like reading through his plays, and like the nurse is one of them. But I do like a lot of the support characters that play with teasing the other characters. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they also come across with one of my favorite terms and also intrinsic in my own comedic stylings, which is the whole malapropism, where you use a word, but you use it incorrectly and you use it to comedic effect, but you do it deadpan. And so if someone knows and understands, you know, what it is you meant to say, they might be amused by it, or it might just go over their head and they may just think you made a mistake and not realize you were joking. And so like, and like as an obvious example, I had a friend in college who said this whenever he had the chance, whenever whenever someone talked about like whether someone was like ambidextrous, he goes, "Oh my god, you could breathe water and air." And like he would play it like he's totally shocked, like, and just, and so that's like a super obvious version, but like I love that way of using language for the unexpected. And so that's why a lot of these times in the movies, it's these moments and phrases that I really catch. And like, I'm gonna guess your favorite person or performance was John Leguizamo.
You know, I had a lot of trouble with this because there are two performances in this that I think are standouts beside the leads.
Sure.
And John Leguizamo is one of them, and the other shouldn't really come as much of a surprise either. That is Mercutio, played by Harold Perrineau. Like the two of them, because the way that they sort of molded themselves into those roles of Tybalt and Mercutio was really unique to me, and really really stood out, especially Harold Perrineau. Doing the sort of drag dance at the party, and being sort of big and larger than life and flamboyant, and then how he sort of came to the defense of Romeo, and the way that the fight between him and John Leguizamo played out, and the aforementioned sort of gun into the ground kind of deal. I loved the performances of both of them. I think John Leguizamo probably edges out just a little bit more, because of his sort of, and it's in the movie with the costume, but his sort of devilish demeanor,
yeah.
And but at the same time being extremely protective of the Capulet family and what, you know, holding the line and things like that, like his loyalty and things like that really stood out to me as well. So that's I think that's why he probably edges out by just like,
I do think that, you know, when you bring that up, it made me wonder a bit, like, I don't want someone to say, I'm gonna make a Romeo and Juliet movie that is 4 hours long and really gets into everybody's relationship so we can understand it better and goes off Shakespeare's script and make it more realistic. I don't want that at all. But I am kind of curious about, they tell us that Julia is close to her cousin. But like, is she, you know, what aspect of, is, you know, is she mourning and hurt by that? And what aspect of that is all the heart aflutter about wondering about, you know, Romeo? And like, so I am curious. They dangle that out there as bait, and I think it's interesting because you just don't see them interact basically at all. I mean, they're in the same room together for a moment, but they don't act together. But it's like things like that, dynamics like that, family, you know, like, because it's such a, obviously it's family versus family, and so wanting to see the dynamic of everyone in the same size of the families interact with each other, I think is something I want a little more of, but I understand. And I'm not wanting a remake where they put in an extra scene just for that. But it is something that I think about.
Well, you know, it's funny you say, like, I don't need a four-hour long movie. I didn't either, but I did feel like maybe I could have used a little bit more. Like, this was 2 hours, but it was a fast 2 hours.
It was like a surprisingly fast 2 hours, because I've had a very busy week or life, but like this, it's so busy, and I'm like, and then I look at the runtime and I'm like, oh, it's 2 hours. I'm like, okay, I'll find time to, you know, when am I going to watch that? And then like,
before you know it, it's over.
It just like, it flew by, and we have absolutely watched movies shorter than this that felt twice as long.
Fucking forever.
Yeah. So yeah, it's interesting that Shakespeare of all things, you know, flew by. I do think that's, of course, a testament to the movie and the style of the director, the performances, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it, you know, of course, goes back to the core of the storytelling and what was, you know, what has been appreciated for hundreds of years at that core level of what makes a story interesting. And In that regard, I mean, one last thing I wanted to touch on was, of course, there are, I don't know how many adaptations of Romeo and Juliet exist in terms of plays and TV miniseries and movies and things. Who knows? But we talked about, you know, with Sherlock Holmes, how there's so many different things with Sherlock Holmes. So now we're go right from, you know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle to Sir William Shakespeare, and right. Not right to it. But like, so there's a lot of history. There's a lot of performances, things like that. But there's a lot of different movies out there that are based on Shakespearean plays that aren't just Hamlet with Mel Gibson, or, you know, like all the different versions of Hamlet that have been made by Kenneth Branagh. And, you know, but I'm talking about, you know, like 10 Things I Hate About You. You know, or I'm talking about, I say there's a million that I can't name.
West Side Story.
Like, of course, West Side Story, which is interesting with the whole Spielberg making a new version of that. Like, okay.
Which I'm kind of interested in seeing.
I'm totally intrigued and interested and in for it, especially with Ansel Elgort, you know, being in the lead. Like, I'm like, that's cool. But as Tony, but I'm also like, who asked for this? But okay, whatever. Things happen all the time that no one asks for, and especially when we're redoing things. But yeah, I saw the little teaser trailer for it. There's some really cool looking cinematography shots. So I'm like, okay, let's dive in. This will be cool. But the one thing that I think is hilarious, and it's pretty obvious, or if you didn't already know just right offhand, that like Lion King is based on Hamlet.
Correct.
But what I found to be hilarious, because I've never seen, I've not seen a lot of like Disney quote unquote sequels, but I was just looking through things and I saw that The Lion King 2 was based on Romeo and Juliet.
I saw that as well, because I was looking at, like, in preparation for tonight, I was looking at like, oh, what are some like more popular adaptations of Romeo and Juliet? And I'm like, wait a minute, what? Lion King 2?
It, to me, it's funny and goes back to the very nature of Disney, in that you have The Lion King based on Hamlet, but, you know, like, everyone's okay at the end. Well, I mean, obviously not his dad.
His dad and not Scar.
Right, but not, so not everyone, but like the main character that you're following, the Hamlet, you know, stand-in is cool, and his, you know, Nala doesn't kill herself or, you know, anything like that.
Right.
And the same with, I'm assuming, I've not seen The Lion King 2, but I doubt it ends in a double suicide.
It probably doesn't, given that it's a Disney movie.
Yeah.
Probably not.
So maybe that's what's wrong with kids these days.
They don't watch enough Lion King 2?
No, that Lion King 2 didn't, you know, it wasn't a true tragedy. So they grew up thinking they deserve everything.
Oh, they're, these damn Gen Z kids think that that's what it is.
That's that, yeah. Blame it on the TikToking.
The TikToks and the flossing dances, the Fortnites.
This just makes me think that if podcasting were around and popular back in like the 70s and 80s, we probably would have thought it was the stupidest thing ever. And that like who wants to hear people's dads talk about movies and things like that? But here we are.
Here we are indeed.
But on the other hand, so, Shakespeare's timeless. So I guess it doesn't matter how old you are.
You were going to ask a question, I think, because it sounded like you were leading to a question. Maybe you weren't.
Don't put your things on me. I was not going to lead up to a question. I was just going to expound and just go on and on for no particular reason and just leave it there. So,
well, all that's right, all. Then.
That was my goal.
Okay.
Put it out on a platter.
Fantastic.
The world decides what the question is.
And we'll come back to it next week. That's our episode, everyone. I want to give a big shout out to Nicole for suggesting this, and happy birthday to you, Nicole. Thanks so much for emailing us. And John's going to tell you folks how to do that shortly. We have new episodes each and every Monday, so come and hang out with us as we distill another favorite from our past. You can catch new episodes on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Stitcher and Google Podcasts and all those different podcast apps. So get it there. Tell a friend, tell a family member. And hey, if you want to support us, I haven't asked this in a while. If you want to support us and help us to make some cool content, you can donate to us. anchor.fm/thememorydistillery/support, and you can give us money to make cool stuff. We'll be happy to do that if you give us money. And we're probably still going to do it even if you don't, but please. We love you.
Absolutely true. And that cannot be clearer than when you look at the song that we chose to use for our podcast, Number One Crush by Garbage, which coincidentally was also on the soundtrack for, you know, Romeo and Juliet, but that's pure coincidence. We did our podcast first, but that's not true because this movie came out in 1996. So I guess the soundtrack came first. Speaking of things that came first, you guys could be the very first person ever to email us at thememorydistillery@gmail.com. Oh, wait, no, you can't, because a lot of you already have. But you could definitely get a part of that action by joining the party and letting us know, you know, you got special events coming up. Do you have things that you'd like us to, shout outs that you'd like to hear on the podcast? Do you have movies that you're just really, really hoping someone would review, but no one ever talks about, but you think it would be a good fit for us? Just let us know. We're always looking for suggestions and things to dive into. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Memory Distillery there on Facebook and join us in on that page for our discussions, and even tweet us at TMDPod or our Instagram TMDPod. So a lot of different ways you can reach out to us. We're always looking to make that connection and get some new ideas. And like Anthony said, happy birthday to Nicole. We're happy to have reveled in this great reworking of a Shakespeare classic. You know, I think next week could be something very interesting coming up, but I won't tell you if I'll be involved or not, because I don't want anyone to like just go, well, John's not going to be there. That can't be amazing then. Oh, wait.
Or can it?
Or can it? No. But yeah, we've got a lot of things coming up here this year, so stay tuned, and thank you again for listening. I'm Prince of Cats.
And I'm that guy. And this has been the Memory Distillery.
That guy. Yeah, that's classic. Good Shakespeare.